Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk about Glengarry Glen Ross, Bear, The Anarchist, A Civil War Christmas, Working, and Golden Boy. Please stay tuned.
Nothing great. What I do is kind of boring. If you'd rather, it can wait. All I am is someone's mother. All I am is someone's wife. All of which seems unimportant. All it is just my life.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, December 17th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and a historian with a number of books in print, the most recent being Broadway MVPs 1960 through 2010, The Most Valuable Players of the Past 50 Seasons. Wow, Peter, that's a mouthful, but it fits very well into stockings, doesn't it?
Depends on the stocking. It better be queen-sized.
And you can get that at Amazon.com. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
I should also mention that Peter also writes for Critcherland.com, Masterworks Broadway, and the MTI website throughout the month. MTI stands for Music Theater International, which some readers have pointed out. They don't know what that meant, but...
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It's a Music Theater International, which is...
Yeah, if you want to rent Guys and Dolls or Music Man to put on your community theater, that's who you give a call to get the scripts and the scores.
Excellent. Thank you. Michael Portantier is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at the Sondheim Review. He also writes for Broadway Stars and many other outlets through the internet. He is a photographer whose work can be seen at Broadway Stars and also at followspotphoto.com. And good evening, Michael.
Good evening. Well, I have an interview with Mitzi Gaynor that just published in Life After 50 magazine, which is an actual hard copy magazine. Imagine that. If you can't find it, you can also read it at www.lifeafter50.com. That's 50 the numerals. And she's really pretty great. So that was a lot of fun for me to talk to her again.
Speaking about Life After 50, Glengarry Glen Ross, you guys got a chance to see it. Peter, we talked about it last week, but Michael saw it this week. So, Michael, tell us, what did you think of Glengarry Glen Ross?
Well, I was, pleasantly surprised overall, just in terms of what I had heard and what I had feared, partly because of the delayed opening. In general, I thought it was pretty good. I thought Al Pacino started out very strong, and he really pulled me in. I found that when he had to do monologues or lengthy speeches, I didn't think he nailed those so much, just because there didn't seem to be any kind of a flow. There seemed to be a lot of... more pauses than I certainly would have put in. And it wasn't just the pauses, it just somehow the rhythm of the monologues and the long speeches really did not work that well for me. But it still was, it was still pretty great, because it's still Al Pacino. And I did not get the impression, that he had any kind of problem at all remembering his lines, I should say. So that, I just want to say that definitely. Overall, I thought it was a very strong production, but not as riveting and not as effective overall as the last one. This one is directed by Daniel Sullivan. It didn't seem as taut. It didn't seem the stakes were as high as they should be in Glengarry Glen Ross. I don't know how to explain it any other way. And for example, Bobby Cannavale, although I thought he was really quite good as Richard Roma, and certainly very colorful, and he certainly had the charming aspects and the kind of smarmily charming aspects of the role down, if that's the right way to put it. I didn't think he seemed as dangerous and kind of nefarious as the character should be. So I thought that part of the role was somewhat shortchanged. And that goes part and parcel to what I was saying as to how the whole production didn't seem as the stakes didn't seem as high, didn't seem as dangerous. Richard Schiff, I thought, was quite good. Let's see. Richard Schiff as George Aronow. Jeremy Shamos doing a wonderful job in the small pivotal role of James Link. Murphy Guyer as Balin. John C. McGinley, I thought was one of the strongest overall as Dave Moss. He really seemed to have the style and the rhythms down. And David Harbour, I have to say, as Williamson, I was also very, very, very good in one of the less showy roles, but also very, very important roles. So I think it's definitely worth seeing, especially if you've never seen Glengarry. Not the best production, but certainly very, very worthy and very well done overall.
Michael, you forwarded on to me that Saturday Night Live link the other day, which was very funny. Peter, have you gotten a chance to see the Saturday Night Live skit?
No, but I know what you're talking about.
You're a rat bastard, Charlie
right.
Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And they had quite a few takeoffs on the Glengarry shenanigans, and one of the inside baseball jokes was, "We're going to keep it in previews forever, so they can't review it." So it was
I'm just very glad that once again Saturday Night Live is acknowledging Broadway, that it's paying attention to what's going on the street, mostly because it is a New York show. Granted, it goes out to the entire country, but the fact that it's a New York show, just as Ed Sullivan once was, and gave Broadway a lot of play, I feel very good when Saturday Night Live acknowledges. I remember being stunned one night when they acknowledged the problems that Seussical was having. They even did it in rhyme, a la Dr. Seuss. So I guess it'd be nice if they were talking about things that weren't necessarily problems, but nevertheless, there's no such thing as bad publicity, as they say. So,
yeah, it was quite a funny skit. If you have 2 minutes or so, go to BroadwayRadio.com. There's a link to it on Hulu that you could watch it, and it's very, very funny.
Good.
All righty, moving forward, we, Michael and Peter got a chance to see Bear. So Peter, why don't you start us off with the Bear?
Well, it's funny, I was walking by the Belasco the other day on a Wednesday afternoon, and I saw 1,000 kids pouring into the Belasco. Their high school teacher was taking them to see Bear, and I think that's great. I'm sorry, taking them to see Golden Boy, and I think that's great because they should see a play of substance, which, of course, Golden Boy is. However, I hope that teacher does take them to Bear. I think this is a show that high schoolers could really profit from seeing because it has a great deal to say about life as a high school kid, especially with gay issues. Now, we're dealing with the story of Peter and Jason. Peter is the type of kid who reads gay. He looks it, so to speak. You know, I mean, nobody knows for sure or anything like that, but nobody is going to be surprised when Peter comes out as a gay young man. Okay. But for Jason, who's very butch, who plays sports, all that kind of business, but is, no question about it, homosexual. It's much harder for a kid like this to have to acknowledge it. He's going to stun his parents. He's going to stun everybody around him. He's even going to take some ridicule for some people who think that this is worth ridiculing a kid for. So this is his journey. And I think it's very effective in terms of book. The music, fine. The lyrics, fine. They rhyme. I'm really impressed. The craft is very good in the lyrics. The performances, all very good, especially the young woman who plays Ivy, because she is the girlfriend. I mean, that's another thing, too. You know, here's Jason with this lovely, lovely young woman who is hot for him. She wants him so badly. And, I mean, there it is. I mean, she makes it so easy for him. I mean, he wants to try to be a straight guy. So why not fool around with her? On the other hand, you know, how does this affect Peter? I mean, he's devastated by this. But Yeah, all these things have, and it comes to a head in deep in the second act, where of course it should. And Jason's sister gets involved, and there's something that is not unlike the Tyler Clementi case that happened. Now, Mark Crawley many years ago said, and I'm going to paraphrase this to be politically correct, the gay guy does not always bump himself off at the end of the play. Well, we'll see if he does or doesn't in Bear. It's certainly an issue that is going to come up. So I thought it was very effective storytelling and certainly a listenable score. I wish it well, but I really hope that teachers will bring their kids to see it. On the other hand, there is a subplot involving the fact that one nun, a very progressive nun, gets into trouble for being honest with kids about this, that, and the other thing. And I guess some high school teachers really have to bring kids to the show at their peril, that they very well may get some strife from administrators. But I'm hoping administrators will be behind these teachers and say, yeah, bring these kids to Bear. It's something that everybody should see. It's really worthwhile for adolescents to be in that theater.
Michael, what did you think about it?
Well, I have very mixed feelings about it because I saw the original version of Bear quite a few years ago in Los Angeles. And I really, really liked it. At that point, it was a sung-through musical. In fact, it was billed as a pop opera. And there was very, very little spoken dialogue in it at all. And then it was done in almost exactly the same form at the American Theater of Actors on West 54th Street here a few years after that. I think it's now, is it 6 years ago? Is that?
I think it might have even been eight. I may be wrong about that, but I thought I heard 2004.
Yeah, I think that actually sounds more accurate. Again, done in pretty much the same form. And then the show was to have transferred to what was then called Dodger Stages after that. But what happened was, in a spectacular case of bad timing, the Dodgers were going through a very, very bad time right around then. And so the show was canceled very, very late in the game. I remember at the time I was the editor of Theater Mania, and we actually did a whole big article, an interview with the three leads ahead of time, and we even put it on the cover of a little magazine, a print magazine that we had at the time, and then the show was canceled. I think it really, I want to say maybe 3 weeks before it was
just very close.
Very close.
Yeah, really
so that was,
yeah.
That was heartbreaking. And then, ironically, not long after that, the Dodgers, had Jersey Boys. So they're fine now, among other successes that they've had since mm-hmm. then. And, but that production of Bear never happened. And also, ironically, the current production is playing at what used to be called Dodger Stages and is now called New World Stages. I think it may even be in the same theater within the complex.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of amazing, kind of really interesting little tidbit there. But anyway, this production is very, very significantly rewritten. There are lots and lots of changes. One of the major ones being that it now has quite a lot of spoken dialogue by John Hartmere, who was originally billed as, I suppose, maybe just lyricist and librettist. But I will say that I thought that most of the dialogue really was excellent. I was very trepidatious because I was not used to it having dialogue, but I thought he has a very good ear. It's to my ear as to how kids talk, and it seemed very natural. And so that's some very good news. There were lots of changes, lots and lots of changes. For example, a major character in the original production was Peter's mother, and they had a wonderful moment where he is on the phone with her trying to come out, and And what was interesting to me was not that he came out and that she was horrified or she hung up the phone or anything like that, but the way they did it was that she just did not want to discuss it. So every time he tried to say it, she would change the subject or she would say something else, and he never wound up telling her. And then after they hung up, then she had basically a song about how she, you know, she knows what he was trying to say anyway. But I thought that was a great moment, and I'm not – and at first, I wasn't sure when I heard that she was cut out of this production. I was not sure why, and I'm still not sure it was the best idea. But I will say that, as Peter alluded, Taylor Trench is playing Peter as very obviously gay. And so in that context, I suppose it would have been a little ridiculous, you know, for someone like that to – you know, to have a coming out discussion with his mother. So maybe that's one reason why they decided to go a different way with the character of Peter and therefore eliminate the mother. There were lots of other changes to Jason's sister, whom Peter also alluded to, Nadia, played by Barrett Wilbert Weed. She used to be a heavy girl, and she had a song about that. And she was basically sort of an outsider, and that was basically what her character was about. Now, she also is she's not heavy anymore. She's much more, you know, much more popular. but she's also she's a drug dealer, and that was. That was a role that was fulfilled in the original production by another character entirely, the character of Zach, if I remember correctly. So they tried to combine several things into the current version of Nadia, and I just thought they tried to do too much there because she seemed like sometimes more of a device than a character. And then there were lots of other changes that I won't go into because there were really a lot of changes. And I kind of felt like for every change they made that was for the better, there was one that they made that was not for the better. And so that's a weird kind of balance, you know. In the long run, I'm not sure overall if the show is better, but it is very different. I do think it works very well with the dialogue, and it's the way Romeo and Juliet is used in public domain, you know, hello, is used prominently in the play because the kids in the school are putting on Romeo and Juliet, and Jason is cast as Romeo, and and Ivy, Elizabeth Judd, is cast as Juliet. So that's how they're kind of thrown together. One of the odd aspects of the show from the beginning is that it's supposed to be a co-ed Catholic boarding school, and I'm not sure if any such thing exists. Peter?
Well, as somebody who went through 12 years of education in a Catholic school, which I'd rather not talk about, no, I've never heard of that either. But it didn't strike me as impossible.
It just seemed odd to me because I don't see any reason why it really needs to be a boarding school as opposed to a regular co-ed Catholic school, of which there are some. I know that for a fact.
That may very well be to address the issue you were talking about the mother, because when kids are at a boarding school, they do have to have an independence, and they do wind up relying less on their parents, obviously, than if they were living at home. So that might have been a convenient device that they decided to use rather than a realistic one. But
yeah, good point. But now, as we've said, now the mother's not in it, so that's
right. Yeah. Sure. But that's one of the reasons why, conceivably, she's not in it, because parents who have kids at boarding school aren't as relevant to their kids' lives. They certainly are relevant to their kids' lives, but not as relevant as a kid who comes home every night and sits at the table for dinner and, you know, have you done your homework and all that stuff. So that might have been an all too convenient ruse to make it. Yeah, it could be, I'm guessing. Yeah. I will say, after saying how much I liked it, and I did, I will say that I did not see it the first time around at ATA on 54th Street. But I will say the people who have feel that it has lost something in the translation, and they don't like the fact that it's a slicker production than it once was, that it had a rawness. This is what I'm
yes,
hearing.
Yes, yes. You know? And as you may have heard, the entire original production is viewable on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
So you can judge for yourself.
That's right, I can.
And it had it had Michael Arden as Peter.
He's a great.
Who's really quite extraordinary. It had a very good cast overall. I definitely agree about the music by Damon Intrabartolo, and also the lyrics. I noticed that actually while I was watching it again, seeing the show again this time, Peter, I noticed that the rhymes were there, and I thought, oh, Peter's going to like this.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, because certainly in so many rock musicals, they don't rhyme, or even Chaplin for that matter, which isn't a rock musical,
right?
They don't rhyme, and it seems to be something that people are going away from. And I do believe that it helps the show when it helps people to understand what's going on, what
absolutely.
Is being said. You know, so that helps a great deal. So my hat's off to them for at least doing the craft right. It may not be super inspired writing, but at least they worked hard, and they prove that one of the main reasons that lyricists don't rhyme all the time is because they're just too lazy to. It takes a lot of work to do it that way. When you find out you can't get the rhyme, you have to start again and go back and find another way of saying things and hoping you'll find a rhyme this time. So credit where credit is due.
I think that's true, but I can't help feeling also, and I'm sure I've said this, that I think that some of them think that it's uncool.
Oh,
Some current writers just think, oh, rhymes? No. You know.
No question. Oh, absolutely true. But really, you know, I mean, they're cheating themselves because people just don't understand. It's very hard to get theater lyrics, especially when a chorus is singing. So as a result, you really have to make it as easy as you can for the people out there watching and listening.
One last thing I must say is and this mystifies me, Peter. I have heard some people say and write, I've seen them write, that they think that the show is dated because of the basically because of the depiction of the situation of gay people in high school. And I do not get it. I don't know what they mean. I wish people would realize that their own reality may not be the reality of everyone else in the world or the country or even, you know, for heaven's sake, we just read the papers and you should be able to see that. I don't think it's dated at all. I don't either.
And especially with the fact that we are dealing with a kid who's really butch.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and that's why the story interested me more than many stories dealing with gay relationships do, because both Stafford Arima, the director, and the people who wrote the show really are careful to stress the fact that this is a living hell for a kid who just cannot be what he wants to be because people just expect him to act in a certain way. And he's typecast, you know, and he wants to play a different role. He wants to be true to himself. And in the meantime, he is ruining people around him, because that's what happens. If you force a kid to be something he's not, it's going to turn out to have catastrophic effects. We certainly saw this in reality last week in Connecticut, but it applies here as well.
And yes, that is an excellent point. I think it's true that in an odd way, it's easier for effeminate, for a non-masculine, for a flamboyant gay male to be out than the jock. And I do have to mention, because we have not yet, Jason Haidt, I thought, was wonderful.
Sure
as
was.
As Jason. He really got, you know, I really saw all that inner stuff going on there. But he did it without like hitting you over the head with it. And I thought it was a beautiful performance.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope the show runs. There really is an audience for this show, and I really, really, really wish it very well. And we'll see what happens, of course. But if there is any justice, there will be kids who need to see this show in that audience.
I absolutely agree. And it is interesting, though. I don't know we'd have to think if there are other examples of two very, very different versions of quote unquote the same show being produced within 10 years of each other.
Well, the one that comes to mind immediately is Strike Up the Band, Gershwin's show from way back when, because there was one that closed out of town and one that came in, and it was highly rewritten, especially with the fact that one of them had cheese as an issue, and that was changed to chocolates, or vice versa. I never remember. I think that's right. But that certainly was true. And, of course, in more recent times, for those of us who went out to purchase New York to see Kiss of the Spider Woman,
oh,
believe me, what wound up at the Broadhurst looked nothing like that show that was at purchase. It really was tremendously improved. So, and that's both of those shows, audiences at the time, Broadway savants at the time were saying, we'll never see those again. And we did. Yeah, you know, so that's pretty impressive. You know, it really is. And the heiress, by the way, the heiress, too, closed out of town in January of 47. It was called Washington Square at that time.
Right.
And by September, it was on Broadway and it was a hit. So it does. It doesn't happen enough. You know, it doesn't usually happen, of course. But just because the show is down doesn't mean it's out.
I was quite surprised to see that Bear had shown up again here in New York, because I remember when it was at ATA and floating around, there was a lot of talk that Jordan Roth was going to produce it, and that never seemed to come to fruition. But Jordan was doing Donkey Show at the time. That was going to be right after Donkey Show, and then it didn't happen. So I figured if Jordan didn't do it, it wasn't going to happen, but I'm glad to see it's happening here.
Well, one thing about it I don't particularly like. Now, let me preface this by saying I went to a press preview a couple of weeks ago for the show and sat second row center, you know, because nobody was in the house and, you know, sit anywhere, and I like to sit close. And the set looked good from second row center. But tonight I was in row K, and it doesn't look as good from there. What it is, it's a million, probably it is, photographs of this, that, and the other one, because photographs turn out to be very important in the plot of this show. Mm-hmm. So it's everybody's photograph, and I think they even said they didn't do much or any doubling. These are all different photographs from cell phones, and from the back, you can't make that out, and it almost looks messy. But the set is a unit set, and it's used for good utilitarian purposes, even to make a confessional, because, yes, the church comes into this too, and the church's responsibility in this matter comes into this as well. So, you know, there's a priest involved, and not in the way you're thinking, who really turns out to have some flaws as well. So, really, look at how much time was talking about it. I mean, really, this is a quality piece of work.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So I wish it well.
Next up on our list, we were going to talk about The Anarchist, which is closed, but we hadn't talked about it. So let's chat about that. Michael, why don't you start us off with this?
Well, I actually, having said before that we should talk about it, I have very, very little to say. I just thought it was kind of pointless. You know, it could have been gripping. I didn't think it was. It's about a woman named Kathy, who has been in prison for many years, 35, I believe.
Mm-hmm. 35.
Yeah, and this other, and she has a meeting with a woman named Anne, who I'm not sure if it's ever actually stated if she's the warden of the prison, or she's something like that. She's obviously someone with in power, you know, with the who has the power to make the decision as to whether Kathy is going to be freed or not. And it's basically an argument, a discussion as to whether she deserves to be set free. And I won't give away the ending, but one thing I will say is that this was the dullest ending of a play that I think I've literally ever seen in my life. If the lights hadn't gone down, I don't think the audience would have known that the play was over. I mean, that's a silly way to put it, but I think you know what I mean. There's nothing in what they said. There was no kind of resolution, which, I mean, I guess that's okay because not every play has to have a resolution, but there was no feeling of any kind of a of an ending. It was terribly anticlimactic and just kind of petered out, if I guess that's the best word for it. So I just thought it was dull and Patti LuPone was quite good with what she had to work with, I must say. Deborah Winger, I thought, was quite poor, but I kept thinking to myself, maybe she is following the ridiculous theory that David Mamet has espoused in recent years, that actors should do is, quote unquote, just say the lines. Now, what that exactly means, I suppose, is open to interpretation. But I think he thinks it literally means say the lines without a whole lot of inflection and without a whole lot of interpretation. I will never forget seeing his play Race, which I didn't like very much overall. But I was astounded by the fact that Richard Thomas, who has been excellent in everything else I have ever seen him in, seemed to be just saying the lines, like walking through the play, one might almost say. And since that's the only time he did it, I can only assume that it was because he was doing what David Mamet wanted him to do. And maybe that's the case with Deborah Winger, which is really too bad because she's been an excellent actress on film. I think a lot of people were looking forward to seeing her on stage, but just a complete waste of time, I thought. And that's really pretty much all I have to say about it.
And Peter, can you say anything about it?
For the first 10 minutes, I thought this is truly atrocious, and I couldn't grab into it. It took me a long time to really grab into anything and hold on. But once I understood what was going on, and I don't think David Mamet made it easy, I was engrossed, and I was concerned about this woman who had done a good deal of time. Now, the question is, has she done enough time, because she did murder someone? And needless to say, the relatives of that person she murdered do not want her out of jail. And, you know, the fact that they're brought up quite a bit is significant, because we have to be reminded of that this was not a theft. Yeah, this was something that was far more serious. A life was lost. And we do get the impression that she has atoned for her sins. She's done it through religion. I believed that she had atoned. And there was a part of me that wanted her to get out and a part of me that didn't want her to get out. And as a result, there was a fair fight in terms of that argument. However, Deborah Winger really played somebody who had a real streak of sadism in her. She enjoyed having the power. She brought up the word power many times during the course of this 70-minute play. And it was very effective to see this person admit, I've got you. You're in the palm of my hands. This is not dialogue. I've got you in the palm of my hand. I can do whatever I want with you. And you really, the show's closed. I mean, so anyway, might as well say, she will not let Patti LuPone, the actress, Patti LuPone is not in prison. Yeah, they took her away after she yelled at the person in the audience for taking the picture. Yes, so she's doing 7 to 10 down at Sing Sing. Anyway, she even does a nasty trick to make sure that she stays in jail. And so the issues, I think, are very potent. This is not one of those David Mamet scripts where people stop and start talking a great deal and people interrupt each other and people start sentences and correct themselves. It really is a much more straightforward piece, much in the way that Boston Marriage was some years ago. So there's not – you might not even know it was by David Mamet if you hadn't read that in the playbill. For me, by the way, Deborah Winger was unrecognizable. This is not the woman I remember from Terms of Endearment, or – didn't she do Urban Cowboy too? I don't mean the musical. I mean the movie.
Yes.
I mean, I was surprised. I even looked at my playbill. I said, I must have missed a slip of paper. You know, she just didn't look like her to me. I didn't necessarily think she was poor. I wouldn't quite put it that way. But it wasn't a great performance, no. But nevertheless, I have to say, after that terrible start, Jeff Sweet, a very good playwright, often says when he's teaching playwriting, he has people bring in their scripts, and he says to them, okay, let's start on page 10. They say, page 10. My God, we got all this exposition from 1 to 9. He says, you'll be surprised. You will see the people will catch on to what you're talking about. Without that, you've labored so hard to put in the exposition and not make it seem clunky for the first 9 pages. But I'm telling you right now, you're going to see the people are going to pick it up. And in a way, I wish I had given 10 minutes late, because I got everything from the final 60 minutes that I would have had, you know, had I just seen 60 minutes and not 70. So I think this play has more worth than it was given credit for. And I also believe that it will rise again. It's obviously an easy show to do off-Broadway. And here we are talking about redemption for Bear, or at least Strike Up the Band and Kiss of the Spider-Woman. Maybe the anarchists will get redeemed one of these days.
I don't know. I mean, you know, if you write a play about whatever, if you write a play about abortion, if you write a play about, God forbid, you know, school violence, you know, a hot button issue like that, it's going to have some inherent interest. And I'm not saying I was completely bored throughout the entire 70 minutes, but I just, you know, I don't think he treated it very well at all, certainly not in the way a major playwright should have. And it would seem that,
I dare say you would have liked it better if Tracy Bennett were playing the Patti LuPone part, because you would be...
Oh, you didn't.
That would be something you can put to sleep, but anyway.
All right, Michael, you got a chance to go see A Civil War Christmas at New York Theater Workshop. Please tell us about that.
Yes, I really enjoyed it. It's by Paula Vogel. It's sort of a Christmas pageant, I would say, performed sort of in the style of a Christmas pageant. And it's set on Christmas Eve, 1864, in Washington, D.C. and surrounding areas. And the central characters, though not necessarily the major characters, are Abraham Lincoln and his wife, played by Bob Stillman and Alice Ripley. And it's, I believe, very heavily based on actual historical fact of little vignettes of things that were happening on that day, you know, that actual day, Christmas Eve, 1864. And there are lots of characters, lots and lots and lots of characters and lots of subplots, things, stories happening, you know, simultaneously and sequentially in various parts of the city. The major flaw, actually, I would say, in the play was an unavoidable one. There was a tremendous amount of doubling, people playing 4, 5, 6 characters each, and sometimes going immediately from one to the other. And that, you know, can lead to some confusion, needless to say. But other than that, I thought it was very, very well written by Paula Vogel. It was something different. It just, the whole style of it was not something you see very often. There's quite a lot of music in it. You know, songs of the day, Christmas carols, you know, contemporary Christmas carols. And so I, you know, kept thinking, will this be considered a musical for awards purposes? It really is. It really could go either way, because there's so much music in it. And yet, you know, the songs are all performed, you know, as if in context where singing would actually happen, and it's not a new score. So, you know, one could also call it a play with music and be equally correct. But I thought it was very well staged, very well directed by Tina Landau, and the cast was very strong. I'm happy to say that Alice Ripley did not have a lot to sing and sounded just fine, because as we've remarked, she has had some kind of pretty major vocal problems in the past few years. But this was just perfect. I mean, people got to hear her sing and without taxing herself. And Bob Stillman, I've enjoyed him in a great many things. I thought he was terrific as Lincoln. It was interesting to see the play right after having seen the film Lincoln. because there's quite a bit of overlap, more than you might think. And most particularly, this thing about this dream that Lincoln had, about being on a ship and headed towards shore, but not knowing where he's going. I don't remember the exact words, and I don't want to say it incorrectly, but that dream is in both Lincoln and in A Civil War Christmas. And actually, Paula Vogel was sitting not right next to me, but two seats away from me when I saw the show in a preview, and I asked her about that, and I said, "Wow, that's incredible! That's amazing! That dream is." I said, "Have you seen Lincoln? It's in that too." And she said, "Yes," but this play, but her play has been it's been done before, and it's been worked on for several years already. So. You know, it's not as if she took the idea from Lincoln. Far from it. So I would really recommend Civil War Christmas. It's at New York Theater Workshop on their very large stage, so they're able to take full advantage of the space in creating this kind of Christmas pageant panorama that they do. So yes, definitely go, I would say.
A lot of our readers, listeners, may very well have met Paula Vogel over the years without knowing it, because years ago she was Betty Corwin's assistant at the at Toft, at the Theater of Film and Theater at the Lincoln Center Library. She might very well have handed you your little cassette when you went to go watch.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's she was writing on the side, and Betty Corwin is very proud of her, as well she should be, that she did work there and did make use of the time when she wasn't working there, to say the least, because she certainly is one of our most intriguing playwrights, and we're always interested to see what she has next up her sleeve. This one, by the way, came as a result of I think it was Molly Smith at Arena Stage saying, you know, we need an American Christmas Carol. That's what needs to happen, and that was the motivation for this. Does it seem like a Christmas Carol at all, Michael?
Not in plot terms.
Yeah.
But that's interesting.
So,
all right. Peter and Michael both got a chance to see Working at 59 East 59. It's a Prospect Theater Company production. And we've mentioned it in passing, but we've not quite reviewed it yet. So, Peter, why don't you start us off here?
Well, at the risk of plugging a book of mine, years ago I was writing a book called Let's Put On a Musical, which was a guide to community theaters and high schools, saying here are the pros and cons of doing a show. And when I submitted the proposal, Working was the example I gave, because I think it's an ideal show for so many people in community and high school theater, especially in community theater, because you can actually get people who play those parts in real life to play them on stage, the waitress, the UPS driver. I think that would be a very interesting production. And also, I think you can go around and get ads for your program from people who do all this. Anyway, so I'm walking down the street and I see Steve Schwartz in the distance. Steve was the brains behind Working. He's the one who read Stud Terkel's book of interviews, where Stud Terkel just went around Chicago and said, "Tell me about your job. What do you love? What do you hate?" And Steve Schwartz said, "Oh, what a great idea for a musical." And he didn't write all of it. He wrote some of the songs and farmed them out to other people, as disparate as James Taylor and Mary Rogers and Susan Birkenhead and Mickey Grant, who, by the way, gets essentially the first act closer and the 11 o'clock number. So he really thought very highly of what Mickey Grant did, and rightfully so. Both songs are tremendous. Anyway, so I'm walking down the street and I see Steve Schwartz in the distance, and the first thing I'm thinking of, you know, I'm going through all these catalogs at the time. Now, this is 20 years ago. I'm going through MTI. I'm going through Sam French. I'm going through Rodgers and Hammerstein. I'm going through Tams Whitmark, and I don't see Godspell anywhere. Now, who handles Godspell? So I see him. I said, Steve, listen, you know, I'm doing this book about community theater and putting on shows there. And I want to know, and he interrupted me and said, oh, I hope you put working in there. Because it really meant a lot to him. This show is really deep and dear to his heart. Mm. And it was so great to be able to say to him, hey, that's what sold the book. I mean, that's the thing I put in the proposal that made it happen. So, and by the way, just for the record, they were doing Godspell on their own. The people who produced Godspell were licensing it on their own. Now MTI does have it. And if you want to do Godspell in your high school, yes, you deal with MTI. Okay. Now, on to this. The working that I saw on Broadway, lo those many years ago, almost, a third of a century ago, is different from the one we have now. For one thing, there was some new material by Lin-Manuel Miranda, who might not have even been around when the first working was done. And he's added a couple of songs that are really quite potent. But the beauty of working is to see that work really is what you make of it. You are seeing people here who are doing the best they can in their jobs or not. Some people hate their jobs, and they make it quite clear that they hate their jobs. I will say that the new version of working goes less on that than the previous version did. We seem to be people who have either made peace with their jobs or love them. And the quintessential example of loving them is the waitress, Dolores Dante. And this woman has such a great attitude about being a waitress that literally, I mean this, when I was in Chicago in 2001, I actually got out a phone book hoping to look her up and call her up and talk. She wasn't listed. So that's how much of an impression this woman makes on me, because she just loves being a waitress and puts the greatest possible spin on it. And also, I really believe that this is Stephen Schwartz's finest song ever. It's an art, where he has so many triple rhymes that are just delicious beyond belief. Some of them he's even dropped, which I'm sorry, because though the chef may be deaf, I stay diplomatic. If I give him static, he might burn the haddock. I mean, that's great. You know what I mean? But he's got a million of them. So as a result, I don't think that one appears in this one. Donalyn Champlin does the song in this one. Donalyn Champlin is really excellent in this show, but everybody is. It's only a cast of six. They work like crazy. They're all around at all times. They have to put on a million different costumes to be a million different people. And but it's really very tear-wrenching so much of the time when people are saying, I love my job, I find importance in it. And also for the people, especially the Mickey Grant song in the second act, where a cleaning woman says, "This, I am the last cleaning woman in my family. This is not happening to my daughter. I am making sure this is not happening." And that's a very moving thing too. But everybody would have to be moved by the end of the first act when Mickey Grant's song, "If I could have been what I could have been, I could have been something." You know, if people let you be what you wanted to be, or if circumstances didn't do you in, because before it starts, people say, well, you know, then I got married. Well, then the kids came, you know, and, you know, there's a million reasons. You know, I was talking the other day about Lorraine Sarabian, who was a Tony nominee for Zorba. She was the leader. She started the show singing "Life is What You Do While You're Waiting to Die." And then we didn't see her for a long time. And I found out that she was temping. And the job opened up, and they said, "Hey, do you know, we can use you." And suddenly, it was like 20 years later, and she still had that job because she just fell into it. And people fall into jobs, and they think they're not going to be there for a while, and they're there for the rest of their lives. And working illustrates this beautifully. And whether you've seen it or you haven't, it's worthwhile revisiting here at 59 East 59th with this fabulous cast and terrific direction.
All right. Michael, what did you think?
Yes, I loved it. I had never seen a stage production. I have heard the original cast recording, which I think only made it to CD quite recently. Isn't that right, Peter?
Well, it was released recently. It did get a release some years ago, but then it went out of print. So it's been out of print as an LP, then it went out of print as a CD. And yes, Masterworks Broadway did reissue it about a year or so ago.
Well, that's what I'm thinking of. Yes. And it's really terrific. This is such a wonderful production. It's the Prospect Theater Company at 59 East 59th Street Theaters. But one interesting thing is it's not in their smallest space, but it's not in their largest space. It's in a quite a small space with quite a small stage. But having said that, it's quite ingeniously staged, directed by Gordon Greenberg and choreographed by Josh Rhodes. The cast, as Peter said, is superb. People I know, people I don't know, Marie-France Arcilla, Joe Cassidy, Donalyn Champlin, who I swear, you know, if this was another time, I think she would be the biggest star on Broadway. She had a great showcase in Hollywood Arms, but then that didn't run for whatever reason. You know, bad luck. She, I guess, took time out to have a child recently. But now she's back. So I predict and I hope for really, really, really great things for her. I keep thinking, aside from her great voice, and she can do everything, drama,
yes,
you know, but she is one of those people who's so naturally funny that it occurred to me that she, if they ever do Once Upon a Mattress again, she's the one who should do.
Oh, good. Yes.
You know, she really, she's that kind of wonderful comedian. Also, Jay Armstrong Johnson, who has been in a few things, but this was a really great showcase for him because he plays several very different kinds of characters with different accents. He was in Hair. He was the understudy for the lead in Catch Me If You Can, but I don't believe he ever went on. I'm not sure about that. And he's going to be in Hands on a Hard Body coming up, so you can see him in that. Then this fellow, Nihal Joshi, who I really don't know, and Kenita Miller, you know, who I do know. So really terrific, really terrific cast, terrific direction, musical direction. This is one of those shows, I'm delighted to say, where the sound amplification was just about perfect. It wasn't too loud. It was not distorted. You could hear all of the lyrics, and that's what I asked for in a sound design. So, you know, really, really props there. I really have to say, looking for the sound design credit. Where is it? Scenic, lighting, costume, sound design, Jeremy J. Lee. Bravo to him. The show has been very ingeniously and very skillfully updated in very clever ways. For example, one of the most famous songs in it is called I'm Just a Housewife. The exact title is Just a Housewife by Craig Carnelia. And so recognizing that term is not politically correct now necessarily or even used that much, it's introduced by the actress saying, well, you know, I'm a stay-at-home mom. I used to be called what I am used to be called a housewife. And that's how they do it. You know, that's how they get the word in there. And then she sings the song exactly as it was written. And I thought it worked beautifully. The new stuff by Lin-Manuel Miranda fits in like a glove, I think. It's modern, and yet somehow it fits in perfectly. There's a terrific, terrific song at the beginning that he wrote called Delivery about a fellow who works in at McDonald's. And the idea is that he is just thrilled beyond belief whenever he has to do a delivery, because it makes him get out into the neighborhood and out into the fresh air. And it just, he's so thrilled and his, you know, his happiness is so infectious. And it has a typically great false rhyme, if you will, by Lin-Manuel Miranda, where the false rhyme is exercise and extra fries. Now, we have gone on and on, Peter and I, about false rhymes, but the thing is, if you do them right, it's hard to explain exactly the difference, but sometimes they're very, very clever and they're brilliant. And then sometimes they just sound lame. It's always hard for me to think of examples in from the Great American Songbook, but there is one that I always come back to in How Long Has This Been Going On by Ira Gershwin, by the Gershwins. I could cry salty tears. Where have I been all these years? I mean, it's elegant. It's beautiful. So I don't know exactly what the secret is in writing false rhymes that are elegant rather than lame, but Ira Gershwin knew it, and Lin-Manuel Miranda knows it, aside from knowing how to write great music. So loved it.
Great. So next on our agenda, we were going to talk about Golden Boy, which opened up December 6th a few weeks ago, but due to scheduling, the holidays and scheduling and all the other things that have happened in the last couple of weeks, Michael's gotten a chance to see it, but Peter hasn't. But we're going to have Michael weigh in on this because Peter's not going to see it till January or so. So, Michael, give us a quick roundup on Golden Boy.
Yeah, I think it's a strong production overall by Bartlett Sher. The best thing about it is, one of the best things is the pacing. It does not flag. The play was written in and is here performed in three acts. At the Belasco Theater, where it originally opened 75 years ago. How cool is that? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's beyond cool as far as I can. Especially since the Belasco just a few years ago was gorgeously renovated. Mm-hmm. That's one of those wonderful things that sometimes happens in the theater. Who knows, maybe that's one reason why Lincoln Center thought to do the show and thought to do it at the Belasco. So whatever the reason, that was a really great thing. The play, it's interesting. It's by Clifford Odets, who's one of our great seminal playwrights. But it's interesting. A lot of the dialogue, it's very quote unquote dated, but in a way it kind of crackles and sounds very modern, especially some of the slang that the characters use. It's set in New York City in the 30s, and the kind of characters you'd expect to see in a play set at that time that involves a lot of the characters are in the boxing world, and they're also just kind of middle and lower middle class characters. So that's really interesting. I thought the casting was a little odd, largely because part of the point of the play is what a melting pot New York was at the time. And it seems like Mr. Sher went out of his way to cast people who not only were not the ethnicities they are supposed to be, but didn't even look or sound like them. Seth Numrick, who is a wonderful actor and has been in many wonderful things, plays Joe Bonaparte or Bonaparte, and he just really does not look Italian in any sense of the word. And, in some plays, it's really not that important, but I do think it is here because it's such a slice of life, melting pot kind of a play. In contrast, the character of his brother-in-law is supposed to be Jewish and much is made of that, but that actor seemed to be. To me, to be very Italian in his body language and his accent. So that was odd. Tom Moody, Joe's manager, basically, is played very, very well by Danny Mastrogiorgio. But again, I don't think he's supposed to be Italian because his name is Tom Moody. And there were three or four examples of that. So I thought that was a little odd. Also, Seth Numrick, does a very, very thick, lower class New York accent. And it sounded very authentic to me, but it also sounded kind of studied and not necessarily spontaneous. I will acknowledge that I think this is partly because when you have seen an actor several times at several different plays, and then suddenly you see him or her and hear him or her doing an accent that they've never done before, it can, you know, that in itself can strike you as kind of odd. So it may partly be that. I don't want to, you know, like, I don't want to come down on him for that too much. But there were some really wonderful performances in the show. Danny Burstein as Joe's trainer, Jonathan Hadari in a very tiny role as a family friend, Tony Shalhoub as his father. There's a huge cast in the show. And in this case, there really was very little, if any, doubling to speak of, and that really adds to it. A for-profit theater doing a commercial production of Golden Boy for an open-ended run on Broadway probably would not have been able to manage that, but bravo to Lincoln Center for being able to do that. I must single out Ivan Strahovski as Lorna Moon, who is involved with two of the major characters romantically, and that leads to, shall we say, tragedy at the end of the play. She apparently, I really am not familiar with her, but I understand that she is Australian, but she does such a perfect lower class New York accent that I was amazed. And aside from that, she seems to have the character down pat. It's a difficult character, not necessarily that sympathetic, but she played it to the hilt. She seemed very, very natural. And I can't praise her enough. Ned Eisenberg, Anthony Crivello, Brad Fleischer, Daniel Jenkins, people, you know, luxury casting in many cases in very, very minor roles. I think people just understandably wanted to be in this production, you know, of a seminal, very, very classic American play at the theater where it was originally done. And so, you know, it's definitely very, very well worthwhile, and Lincoln Center should be very proud of it.
One of the interesting things about Golden Boy when it became a musical in 1964 was the fact that Joe's last name was changed. It went from Bonaparte to Wellington, and that's very interesting because Napoleon Bonaparte fought the Duke of Wellington in that famous Battle of Waterloo almost 200 years ago. So there's a little irony there. And of course, the musical took the story a step further because it was Sammy Davis Jr. who was in love with Paula Wayne, a name we haven't heard of in a long time, who was a white woman, and that raised the stakes considerably higher. Mm. So Golden Boy is a good musical, you know, and I am looking forward to seeing the play version to see how it compares.
Can you remind me, I don't know the musical that well, Peter, in the play version, Joe, the major conflict is Joe originally wants to be a violinist and is a very talented violinist, and he sort of gets sucked into boxing because it's easier and he's talented there too and he can make a tremendous amount of money. But I couldn't remember if in the musical if the subplot is he a violinist or is he a singer?
No, he's not a violinist. But one can picture Sammy Davis Jr. playing the piano rather than having a violin tucked right under his chin. So they started out, when the show started out in Philadelphia and came to Boston, he was a pianist.
Okay.
And there was a great deal of concern about his hand being broken. As time went on, they dropped that. It was just about being a disaffected young man. That's all it was. Somebody.
Oh, really? So he's. Yes. So he's not really, there's nothing else that he and his father want him to be. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
The father doesn't want him to box because he thinks it's terribly low class.
Okay.
And thinks that that's where black people are typecast.
I see.
Yeah. And feels that it's a step down. There's also a minor character in the musical that's very interesting, Frank, his brother, who's a freedom fighter. Who winds up getting beat up too, but for a very different reason from Joe's. Joe does it in the ring. He does it in Montgomery, Alabama. He gets beat up for a far more worthy cause. So one of the problems with the musical is that character of Frank, who's barely on stage, takes your interest because you know what's at stake for the civil rights movement when this show is done. So it's very good musical with a wonderful score. Some even say Charles Strauss's best because I thought a lot of Charles Strauss's score actually, which is a nice compliment with terrific Lee Adams lyrics, especially one with Tom Moody where he talks about, "Here I am, Thomas J. Moody, 3-year-old suit, from Robert J. Hall." I don't know if you remember Robert Hall, which was a really lowbrow type of establishment where you bought clothes. "Jesus H. Christ" is what he says next, you know. So it's really quite good. And there's a great number, too. Don't forget 127th Street, where Joe's friends and relatives talk about, "Hey, if you become this big shot, don't forget us back here." And one of the lyrics is, "The neighborhood is classy. We got rats as big as Lassie." So really good lyrics. So that's worth investigating, too. I'm certainly looking forward to seeing the play, but I might just play my Golden Boy album when we get off here. Sammy Davis made two of them. He didn't like the way he sounded on the first one. He went back to the studio many years later, I think. If not many years, many months later, and re-recorded his songs. Even that was kind of interesting. So, yeah.
Is that beautiful song, Night Song?
Night Song is really great.
There's the hit, I think, was This Is the Life.
I don't think that was a hit. It's a nice song. "I Want to Be With You" got a few recordings between Sam and Joe and Lorna.
Interesting. I think "This Is the Life" was used in a commercial. Maybe that's why I have it in my head as a hit.
I have to say, Charles Strauss is one of the best at getting those songs into commercials. He works very hard at that. He really does. I'll never forget being in a mall and hearing "What a Country" from All American as an Amtrak commercial. So, I mean, that is a definite thing that he looks into. So I believe you, Michael. I believe
you. All right. So that wraps up our reviews for this evening. Do you guys have anything you want to add before we wrap for the night?
Yes.
Let's see.
Anything coming up for you guys in the next week or so?
Not as much, because certainly it slows down.
I'm seeing a couple of holiday themed shows. Maureen McGovern, as I believe I mentioned, is going to be at 54 Below this week. I'm really looking forward to that. She was our guest on the podcast last week, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, last week.
Yeah. And my friend Steven Brinberg is doing his Barbara Streisand Christmas show also at 54 Below. And Natalie Douglas, a really, really excellent, wonderful, great pop jazz singer, is doing a New Year's Eve show at the Duplex. And Marilyn May is doing a New Year's Eve show at the Metropolitan Room. So I don't think I'm going to get to all of those, but there's really a lot to see.
I will say something I've mentioned before, that on Friday night at 7 o'clock, there's going to be some sort of Christmassy type show. It may just be a chorus. It may not be anything ornate, but it's going to be at the Mark Hellinger Theater, now known as the Times Square Church.
Yes,
that's right. Yeah.
And I'm going to – don't anybody go and sit in H19, because that's where I'm sitting, because that's where I sat when I first went to the theater for the very first time to see My Fair Lady. So don't – nobody take that seat.
Because you'll be ejected from it. Someone made the excellent suggestion, we had discussed that the Foxwoods is being sold, and someone made the absolutely fabulous suggestion that the church that now occupies the Hellinger, which supposedly has been looking for a larger space anyway.
Right.
Should sell it back to the Niederlanders or whomever and move in to the Foxwoods. So I don't suppose there's any real chance of that happening, but how fabulous would that be?
Yeah,
it would. I wonder if they'd be reluctant to be on 42nd Street. There is something reasonably placid and quiet on being 51st.
But Peter, actually 43rd Street
is
one of the, is one of the few
that's fair
quiet blocks left in the,
that's fair.
And there is the other entrance there. So that would be perfect.
Ever since the New York Times paper trucks don't run up and down 43rd and 44th these days, that's a very quiet block.
Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, it really is. It's been slow to be to have things move into the building where the Times used to be. I think some of it is an apartment building now.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of businesses and restaurants and stores on that block. Well, anyway, we're going on and on about something that's not going to happen. I'm sorry.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button there. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. In case you don't want to listen in iTunes, you can also listen to us through the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device or your BlackBerry. You can listen to us in a streaming form rather than downloading it and synchronizing it. Or you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. On the show page at BroadwayRadio.com, we also have links to all the stories and different things we've talked about, as well as I'll throw in a link to Peter's book so you can grab it at that last-minute present right before Christmas. And also we have the link to Life After 50 with Mitzi Gaynor by Michael that he wrote that we mentioned at the top of the podcast. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino thanking everybody for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Life is in the air as the night comes and the town awakes. Sounds of children calling and the squeal of brakes. Music, but a lonely song. When you can't help wondering, where do I belong? Where do you turn when you burn with this feeling of rage? Who do you fight when you want to break out but your skin is your cage? Uptown, just another Joe. Downtown, where you gonna go? For that place to be. Where's that bright tomorrow for a guy like me? Damn. Life is going by. Stand.